You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Tom Jennings, artist from L.A. He's talking to me from L.A. Tom, thanks so much for being with me today.
Oh, sure. It's a pleasure.
Tom, I know you're in the middle of a lot of things, and we're going to talk about some past projects so the audience understands a little more about what you're doing. But what is happening this summer? What are you working on this summer? Is there any project or activity you're involved in?
Well, it was beginning of June, wrapped up the last semester of CalArts, and then there's always a bunch of slowdown and, you know, quiet time after that. I'm now in the lurch of summer. I'm thinking about new projects, trying to clean up old ones, and in the meantime, I'm getting ready for doing about 2,000 miles of driving next week in a rally. So
tell me a little bit about that. I'd like to hear a little bit about that rally and how you prepare for 2,000 miles of driving. I mean, that's a lot.
Well,
what does that mean? Like, what kind of car and how is that rally structured?
Well, so here's the thing. As soon as you mention automobiles to anybody involved in artwork, their brain turns off. it's funny that automobiles never make it into art in any guise. Once in a while, you'll see the Hulk of one by a famous artist in a gallery. But not automobiles as for their main function, which is moving bodies around. It's the prosthetic extensions of human bodies. That's how I think of them. It's a mechanism that when it's working right and you're doing it right, I'm picturing on the open road, not stuck in traffic, keeping at your neighbors. When you're cruising down the road and looking around and you hit a pothole, you sort of think, ouch. When, of course, it didn't hurt, you just hit a pothole or a bump. And that implies that your automobile has become a prosthetic device. It's an extension of your body. You're literally feeling the road. That's the state I do often achieve. That's what to me is interesting about automobiles. The automobile hobby and industry are pretty well known and fraught with all kinds of tedious and mundane complexities, which I'm not much interested in. The automobile I'm driving is, it used to be a 1961 Rambler American. It has been rather severely modified. So let's see.
And what does that mean? I want to talk a little bit more about that just to understand, and that's very interesting what you're saying about, you know, prosthetic, you know, extension, because, of course, I relate to that. In how did you modify that, and what is it going to be like? Yeah, let's talk about how you modified that and how you'll be racing it or how you'll be going into the rally.
Well, okay, so at essentially the most mundane level, like four wheels in the ground, windshield in front of you, engine, transmission, rear axle. You got to make it go. It's got to be reliable. I've driven old cars all my life on and off, as well as modern plastic ones. For some reason, like baby ducks following somebody, I got stuck on Ramblers as a brand. They were American-made car. They were made in Kenosha, Wisconsin. They went out of business sort of 1.5 times. The last time was they were sold to Chrysler. My particular car was made in 1961. It was one of the more popular models. There was probably 25,000 of them. They were third in sales in 1963. It's a very plain, old-fashioned, and very small car. It's very, very small. It's sort of, I like to explain it as it's the equivalent of a Honda Fit for 1961.
Right.
They got high 20s miles per gallon. They weren't very fancy. They were reliable. Your grandmother drove one. They were easy to drive. They were also extremely backwards and old-fashioned, but they were very high quality. So anyways, by today's standards, they're pretty peculiar. So the mundane part, well, in 1961 car of an obscure brand that went out of business over 30 years ago is not exactly common, but it has all the problems of old cars. The doors rattle, windows leak, engine is dead. So to make a long story short, I decided when I was going to build this car that I was going to eliminate all the things that drove me crazy. And I ended up with what's called a roadster. So there's no doors, there's no roof. There's a decently performing engine and a modern 5-speed transmission, and it's software-driven engine management that I wrote. which is half of the fun of the project. And I built it. It's kind of a, it's, I built it for endurance, but it's also all almost entirely homemade at this point, from the wheels up. So it's also a little bit of a challenge to do long trips. So because if something breaks, you, I literally cannot buy parts. I have to make my own suspension parts and things like that.
Well, you're also exposed to the elements completely in a long trip, which is unusual for any vehicle other than a motorcycle.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are convertibles, but most people pop the top up and they have radios and AC and heat. I have none of those things. It's too noisy to listen to the radio. There's no heat, no cooling. Well, plenty of cooling. There's air coming in from all sides. Right. But, you know, again, it's a rather stark. It was intended to be a prosthetic device for a really particular kind of experience. I'm not sure art-wise where it's going. It's essentially a drivable sculpture in an obvious sense. You know, it physically exists. It is handmade, and but its purpose. You know, I know that using automobiles as artwork, especially for their intended purpose, kind of automatically exits me from consideration of most people's idea of art. I don't really care. It's not my concern.
Hmm. Well, and so what about the rally itself? I mean, it sounds like art to me. You know, I mean, I think in one way, you know, when artists do whatever they do, I'm an artist, I do these interviews, or the interviews are, you know, yeah. You know, they may not be, but it's I can say it's part of my practice. It's part of the way an artist thinks in terms of how I approach it. So I think, you know, as an artist, you know, driving cars, rebuilding, you know, and doing all the things that you're doing, it's through the lens of an artist. So whether it's art that's sold and resold and in a gallery or not, it's still part of your practice, as I see it.
Oh, it is. It is. And so the part of it is that it doesn't exist in a vacuum. I mean, I think a lot of car people do just sort of make them and polish them and drive around and then just bring them home and polish it again. This car doesn't get polished. It hasn't been painted in 40 years. The purpose of this thing is essentially a performance, right? I'm in it. I'm driving. But this rally is an odd rally. It's called it's run by a group called 24 Hours of Lemons, punning on the 24 Hours of Le Mans in France, because no one can afford Le Mans. The Lemons crowd started out doing about 10 years ago now, what they call crap can races, $500 cars for 24-hour endurance race. So they're all silly and jokey and fooling around, but they're sort of very serious about the culture and the hands-on and the camaraderie and the sharing that it takes to make $500 cars run for 24 hours in a harsh environment. So the rally is, their motto is, why break down on the racetrack when you can break down on the road? So this is the third rally, second one I'll have been on. First one, the most recent one, Moscow to Paris. It was Moscow, Pennsylvania to Paris, Maryland, or something ridiculous. And it was in February. I don't know if you can really conceive of a rally in broken down open cars in winter. But I can't, so I didn't go. The last one was in Death Valley in August. That wasn't a good idea either. So it was a lot of fun. And the next one, next month, we're leaving Monday, is from Monterey up through Oregon to Bremerton, Washington, to Bend, Oregon, and back to Monterey. Then we drive back home.
Wow. So how many hours will that be in total?
Oh, it'll be, let me see, 5 days solid driving. So we're doing about 3,000 miles total. And my friends are coming from Tucson, and they're bringing a 1961 Corvair, air-cooled Corvair, which they put a large home stereo in the back seat, including reel-to-reel tape deck, home-type speakers, and 8-track technology. Your listeners that actually know what 8-track is. Or can buy 8-track recorders or 8-track recorded tapes because they were never made available. So, so it's kind of a tour de force of stupid and foolish technology wielding. To make all this stuff, to make 50 and 60-year-old stuff go for that long a distance, you can't take it too seriously, but you have to be really serious about how you make it go. So it's a nice thought.
Well, because you're maintaining it along the way, it will break down most likely, and it's also about fixing it on the road, as you're saying, right?
Yeah. Now, I'm doing something that's slightly different than most of the other rally participants. My car isn't one of the $500 crap cans they just make go for the event. This is sort of a project of mine that I want to bring home, and it should be fairly reliable, but, you know, you never know. Yeah, I can't ever tell, but I've done trips with this thing, long trips before, so it's fine.
But, I'm glad we talked about this. Go on.
So that part is fairly straightforward in its automobile. This summer has been sort of a pivot from my past work to whatever the hell the future brings. And all of it involves, God, it all sounds highfalutin, but it's all about involved embodied cognition. There's no other way to get around that.
That's fine. Let's talk about embodied cognition.
Yeah, my interest I've been a computer programmer all my life, more or less, since I was a teenager. And so I like that thought, and I came at it from kind of a hardware head end. But starting with the 80s, I got more interested in history, historiography of the fields that went into it, mathematics and system design. And later on, and sort of currently, there's the movement of mechanization of thought, which started to happen post-war with, who can think of the name, McCulloch and Pitt, who's the woman, anthropologist, really famous, his name escapes me. I should look up names. I'm terrible at recalling names. Anyways, there was a large movement of thinking machines and mechanization of thought in the 40s and 50s that was quickly understood to be, Marvin Minsky, all those guys were involved.
There we go.
Was rapidly found to be grossly unlikely to happen in the next couple of decades, in spite of the claims. I actually have a book here from 1951 that says, by this time next year, we will have a functioning English to Russian, Russian to English computer translating program. I don't think we have one today. Google does a not bad job of reading street signs.
Right.
And I find actually not so much the foolishness of the claims, but the process by which they got there, besides the usual over-enthusiasm and not checking your facts well enough, there's this amazing lack of knowledge about how the brain works and how people think. And we're also blinded by ideology, Cartesian ideology, the separation of brain and body, of mind and body. It blinds us to the fact that it's nothing like that whatsoever. That our brains, our minds are made out of meat and atoms, and they are bound by the rules of physics at a very, very low level. That there is no mind outside of a body. This is outside of and separate from religious beliefs. The mind is not contained in a free-floating, whatever, spirit. It's embodied in your meat. And that from this is a bunch of ramifications on how we move, how we think, how our machines work, how we need to solve problems. And the history of algorithms feeds into this, the idea of having a planned sort of step-by-step method for doing something like a cooking recipe lends one to think that you can mechanize all thought. And I think that's where some of those early 50s claims came in. And the biggest mistake I think they made, that's been historically made, and especially in that era, was the confusion of metaphors and the targets of those metaphors. The brain is like a clockwork. It's very complex, and it runs in cycles. The brain is like a steam engine. The brain is like a telephone network. The brain is like a computer. The brain is like a network. It's none of those things. Those are really useful analogies, metaphors we use to think about how we think. But we're not going to figure out how we think by thinking about how we think. I think that's what I think we're at the point where functionalist philosophy that likes to think we're going to talk our way out of this paper bag are just bluntly wrong. We're at that point, I think, where astrology splits off from astronomy and that certain kinds of philosophy are just bankrupt. It's interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. So So where do we go with that? How I mean, all those analogies are wrong. That's true, or they're poor.
Well, they're useful. Yeah, they're useful, but they're extremely limited, and most of them have been supplanted by, like I said, cognitive science. There's a Lakoff and Johnson, two researchers, have published a number of books, Metaphors We Live By, and more recently, Philosophy in the Flesh. In Philosophy of the Flesh, they point out, look, we're not going to think our way out of this paper bag. We need to do this sort of empirically so we can test it. But at the same time, that kind of methodology doesn't necessarily apply very well to organisms. So we have got to come up with new methodologies, you know, empirical-like methodologies by which we can do testable, you know, reach testable conclusions. Now, this isn't overly simplistic mechanization of, you know, of brains and humans, and it doesn't let us off the hook for ethical and, you know, ethical and moral and other concerns. You know, it's not to say we're, you know, fate is sealed and we're just machines. We have choice, however it might be arranged.
Right.
And so, and it's very fascinating. It is very fascinating.
And so some of your projects are exploring that as well, aren't they?
Well, I'm just an artist. I'm not a cognitive scientist. I'm not a physicist. I'm not, you know, et cetera. I can just poke around the edges. A Coyote Protocol project, which is amusingly or not so amusingly to me, not been completed, is that it's sort of a moving target. It was the idea of making machinery. The Coyote Protocol, the name comes from a really disgusting approximation of how dogs and coyotes work, which probably insults dogs. But when dogs are alarmed, like humans, they yell, they bark. You know, there's angry barks, there's happy barks, there's bored barks, there's coyote singing, which is certainly social and has varied meanings. So I decided to just sort of reduce this to a subset that I can encode in software, make a half dozen little boxes that use audio singing, and they listen to notes, and they respond. And what is going to be an external stimulus, if you walk near them, if you get too close, they get upset, and they'll start howling, and all their neighbors will start howling. When everything's okay, left to themselves, they'll start singing songs. Some of the stuff that's interesting to me in there isn't so visible, which is, how can I make small electronic and computer-driven things be self-organizing at a fairly simplistic level, but nonetheless. So the idea was, you have however many of these little coyote boxes you have, like half dozen. You turn them on, they don't know anything, and they all randomly start to sing, but at different times. So one of them sings first. And that song that it sings is its song. And the others hear it, and they make up a song that's different from theirs, and that's their identities. And then they figure out their relationships. And I have all the mostly identity stuff working, but I got sort of bored with I got frustrated with the actual limitations of some of the choices I made in technology, so I got to redo it from scratch.
And so where's the process? Yeah, I mean, keep talking about that project, but so then, how was that project shown, displayed, and it was going on for several years, right?
Well, no, it's never been. I've never actually completed. I mean, I've made a couple work. I've made two of them talk to each other, and then I realized the hardware I had decided to make, the electronics and egg, was far too complicated. I decided to make new ones. I get distracted by, you know, work and school and other projects, and it just keeps getting put off. I haven't forgotten it. This summer is my consolidation summer, and I'll certainly go back to it. And over the winter, I picked out a new processor that lets me do a lot of things in software. When I started this, I had to build hardware to do it. Now I have cheap processors. I can do this basically in software. The other limitation is these are small battery-powered boxes. They're not desktop computers, which puts some severe limitations on them.
Right, but even with this project and the car that you're talking about, there, in all ways, and in the car included, which is an interesting example, because as you're saying, it's not something that easily fits into an art category or is thought about that way, but they're all the car, when you talk about, you know, an extension of ourselves, we're you're talking still about the same issues that you're talking about in your art and your research about cognition. Is that correct?
Yeah, and our place in the world and culture and you know, in our relationship to, you know, people say the word technology. Obviously, I've been having, it's basically been sort of an extended argument, like the Monty Python skit. I'm here for an argument. No, you're not. about what technology is. Science is not technology. Technology is not science. Technology uses some of the fruits of the labors of science. And science certainly, especially now, is doing a lot of work at the behest of technologists. But not every complicated physical device is a technological device. Galileo made telescopes that were certainly not technology. They were scientific instruments. Like worked with Professor Simon Penny, and he came up with that word. He realized that the word instrument actually kind of embodies what I'm trying to say. An instrument, either musical or, you know, laboratory instrument, is not necessarily technology. It may, you know, if it needs to contain some computation, you go to the store and you buy a computer and stick it in. But it's not inherently technological. So I'm more interested in the instrument angle of things rather than playing with products. I mean, used products, who doesn't? That's fine. I'm playing around the edges of this stuff.
Which is interesting because it's all, I mean, you have to move around the edges, as you're saying, because thinking about this, I mean, it's interesting to do an interview about this because it's hard to grasp or put into words in some way, but it's moving around the edges, as you're saying, which feels to me like a more artistic approach as opposed to a purely scientific approach. It's moving around the edges with some of these projects that are approaching what you are researching,
yeah,
or want to discuss, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, computers are interesting. We all use them and all that stuff. But underneath it, well, they contain, you know, decades and in some cases literally centuries or a millennia of thinking about algorithm and thinking about, you know, how to mechanize thinking. How do we arrange our thoughts and processes? How do we solve problems? There's a long history of that, and there's been convergence and divergence. You know, Persians did a lot of what we would call straight-up algorithmic work, including the word itself, but also machine, like self-controlling machinery with feedback, water leveling things, fountains for rich folk to play complicated games with level. Then there's things that when you look back on them, we now, this is the part of the problem with the historiography part problem, is that things that were not considered to be, say, a complex feedback device was a complex feedback device. Now, the tank in the back of a toilet is a complicated, well, it's not that complicated, but it's a feedback device. You flush the toilet, the water runs out, and then the water is low, and then the valve opens, and then the tank fills up until the valve says the tank is full, then it shuts off the water supply. That's feedback. Now, it hasn't worked. A 2017 toilet tank isn't any more intelligent than a 1901 toilet tank. It's how we thought about it that has changed. Mm-hmm. Though I'm sure no one's really concerned about toilet tanks, James Watt's steam engine speed regulators, or the flying ball governor, is a feedback device. The first electric feedback device that I have found is a Hungarian carbon arc lamp from about the mid-19th century. And Hungarian lighting, actually, the Hungarian technologists had a light bulb, a filamentary light bulb, 20 years well-documented before Edison did. Unless they made up all the evidence, but I'm not going there. I don't think so. Anyways, so they had a light that has a carbon arc lamp that you make a big spark, and if you push it too far together, it sticks and the light goes out. You pull it too far apart, the light goes out. It's had a self-controlling mechanism to put the rod in and out of the arc to make it the same brightness all the time if the arc was burned up. Quite amazing and clever. That's clearly a feedback device, circa 1850. But it wasn't thought of so formally. The concept of feedback is a very 20th century idea. And so our thinking about and a feedback device like the James Watt speed generator, not so much the toilet tank, that's not interesting. Or the carbon arc lamp, that is a job done by a human. The bulb is getting too dim, you push the rod in or you pull it back out to control the brightness. We substitute a little machine that never gets tired, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's social and cultural implications of machines replacing humans that goes back, to the Jacquard loom days. And probably before. And amusing of the Jacquard loom, the card mechanism itself was the thought experiment used by Babbage and those guys for making machines that modify themselves, digital computers.
Right. Well, which is beginning to happen, but like you're saying, it's how we're thinking about it as opposed to what's actually happening.
Yeah, I mean, you change. I'd have to get ready to talk about this and prepare myself because it gets a little deep, and I haven't looked at it for a while. But we embrace some new idea. Well, a new idea presents itself, and it's resisted, or it's too complex, and no one notices or cares about it. But it soaks into the background, and it makes a huge change. Like feedback, for instance, electronic feedback was originally used explicitly for gun control by the Navy in the teens and 20s, and was slightly developed by some engineers and scientists at Bell Labs for electronics and electronic field, the same concept, not the same physical mechanism. And it, amusingly, was sort of resisted by some of the Bell Labs for what amounts of arcane technical reasons. It was wasting gain of tubes. But they realized, the engineers were pushing, like, look, if you use this feedback, we can make these amplifiers really stable so we can have longer distance phone calls. The concept of feedback, which seems really arcane and obscure, is applied to, there's no thing that you use today that has not explicitly been discussed in terms of feedback theory, what became cybernetic theory in the 40s. So the two things of the 20th century that are really fascinating to me and to lots and lots of other people and pretty well known are feedback, which led to cybernetics, man-machine stuff, and the machine that modifies itself, which is really what the computer, when we say the computer, like the desktop, laptop kind of thing, it's a machine that modifies itself. The program is not contained in the mechanism like a steam engine. The control mechanisms of the computer are stored in software, which are put into memory, and the same program can write to memory and all that kind of stuff. Those two ideas kind of really shifted everything. And they're really directly involved in thinking about what it is to be human. But now I think in the last 5 or 10 years, people are starting to realize what it means to be an organism. The organisms are sort of outside, or we sort of stand outside of the simpler physical world, and that we do stuff because we want to, or because we can, or we can try it.
Right, right. No, that's very interesting. I wish we could talk more about this because it is a huge subject.
I know.
And really interesting. No, but I'm glad we talked about this. I want to ask you before we go, what book you're reading now, which maybe will allow us all to get further into this.
Well, I usually read like 3 at once, and so I've got. My books have to counterbalance each other. Reading about network architecture by John Day, Patterns in Network Architecture. It's not that new. A book called Der Klang der Familie, a German book on techno and Berlin and the fall of the wall era, which I'm really interested in. And I'm rereading a John Varley novel, Titan, which is as good as I remember from the 80s.
Tom, I want to thank you for talking to me today. It's really been a pleasure.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, I got a little long-winded. Once I start down this path, that's why this summer I'm rethinking it all.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.